listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And we've got Rob Arbiteur.
Hello, Mike.
Martin and Bobby are not with us.
Hello, Mike!
Once again. A little suspicious, that's all I can say. And today, joining us on the Audio Nowcast, we have Tom Gleason.
Hey, everybody.
All right, Tom.
Yay!
Tom's an old school sound effects editor. He used to work with Hanna-Barbera and worked on all the really cool cartoons, Huckleberry Hound, all those good ones. And we're gonna be visiting with him a little bit later. But Tom, welcome, to the Audio Nowcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, today we're gonna talk about a couple things. But right off the bat, I want to tell everybody, especially since Bobby and Martin aren't here, I don't know what you guys do besides doing music, but I wouldn't play soccer with those guys. And
you
let
did?
Me tell you, yeah, because they do there's a bunch of English guys, a bunch of guys go out, older guys go out and play soccer. And let me tell you.
A bunch of older guys. Let's repeat that.
a bunch of older guys.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, Bobby and Martin, those guys are really good.
Really?
Really good. Bobby is just, he was out there just dribbling that ball around. He was attacking. He played in wing. And Martin is a beast on defense. I mean, you know, Martin's tall anyhow, right?
Right.
It's just like, he is such a big presence on the soccer field. It was really amazing to see those guys just, they're good. As a matter of fact, I was playing goalie and Martin, there was a corner kick and Martin, you know, came up and, headed it into the goal, and I punched it out over the top of the goal, and paid for it because there's one of the guys that was on his team just took my legs out and just boom, I landed flat on my back. It was like you know, welcome to the pitch, boy. I bring it up because I was just kind of curious if you guys do anything else, you know, when you want to get away from music. I mean, do you have any outside hobbies or anything like that? I was just kind of curious if you do anything besides, you know, music or audio to help you kind of rejuvenate yourself to get back to it.
I'd have to say for me, it kind of comes and goes. If I'm in a really busy period, then there's no time for anything else.
Right.
I used to love to go to the gym all the time. There were a bunch of things I would do when I had the time, but right. I haven't had too much free time lately.
What about you, Andrew? Do you do anything?
Well, I mean, not specifically. I've got my family, so there's always something going on. With my kids, there's always at least 12 things going on at once. So I'll just wander into the house, and then that's it. I'm occupied.
Scott, do you have any outside things besides audio?
I don't know, if it's kind of like sleep, car, studio, car, sleep, car, studio. I've got a family too, and my son will pretty much take every moment that I've got that I'm not doing anything else. For me though, I think the thing I enjoy doing the most is anything on or under the water is where I want to be.
Oh.
So when I'm not in the studio, I want to be on a boat or under the water, scuba diving,
right,
or anything water-based is where I'm happiest.
Well, that's great. You know, I found that, well, after I stopped hurting, which was like 4 days later, you know what? It was really good. And actually, you know, getting away from, you know, being in the studio and just like seeing the sky and fresh air did a lot for my soul. And just, you know, sometimes you got to step away. Sometimes you get too close. And I just finished a really hellacious, well, a couple of weeks that I mentioned on the last podcast working on that, all that stuff for the, DVD that I was working on, but it was just, you know, sometimes when the pressure gets going, sometimes you just got to walk away. You just got to do something, just take a giant left turn and you know, do something else. I mean, do you guys find that, you know, in the middle of the crunch time, just going outside and taking a break, you know, really helps you out, really kind of revives you?
Oh, yeah. Every now and then you have to just take a deep breath and kind of put everything into perspective.
Or a big drink.
Or both.
I mean, seriously, like Andrew, when you're mixing, you know, some of those killer sessions that you mix, do you ever just like, I just have to stand up and go outside?
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Just, you know,
yeah, all the time.
Just to give your ears a rest.
We've talked about it a million times because also things are so much easier the next day than they would be if you just kept going that night.
Yeah.
You got to get out, take a break, and come back, and everything makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. But do you guys find, though, on projects, I call it time travel, where what you'll do is you'll have a conversation with somebody, said, hey, we'll get together, we'll do this. All right, let me finish this project, and we'll continue the conversation. Well, sometimes you finish that project 4 to 5 months later. And the weird part is when you meet up with that person, you actually go back into that mode, and you're like, oh, hey, and da-da-da-da, but I got another project. So I find sometimes I've had conversations that last, like, 2 years long, because you keep jumping from projects, or the schedules don't match, and you think you just saw the person, you know, a week ago, and you find out it was 4 months.
That was Rob and I's relationship at the NAMM show. It was like on a yearly basis. We'd see each other
for an hour a year. Yeah.
Yeah, we'd go out to dinner, see each other. Okay, see you next year. But, anyhow, so if you're out there and you're just frustrated or had a creative block, go outside, go play soccer. Go play soccer with Englishmen if you
want.
Take
a ball and kick it.
Then go to the pub afterwards.
Exactly.
That's a big part of it.
There you go. Just be prepared for the pain. Well, anyhow, let's move on. One thing I wanted to talk about is I just wanted to mention that right now one of the really big hip games that's out is Crysis. And I don't know if you guys play video games, but I'm addicted to video games. And actually, Scott did some work. His studio did some work on Crysis. And I just wanted to have Scott just mention a little bit about some of your work that you did do on Crysis.
It was good. We created creatures and weapons and environments, and we worked on it for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And, when we first started on it, there was no PC around that could actually run it. When you look at the Crysis engine and the stuff they do with environments, it's pretty scary. They had a game called Far Cry. And the leaves and the shadows, I mean, usually you take that stuff for granted, but when you looked at it, and I remember the first video or first cinematics they showed us, which wasn't even part of Crysis, but part of another project.
Right.
It was amazing at the lighting and the textures. We just thought it was video. And then all of a sudden, we saw guys walking around, so the motion capture, it all looked like it was shot on video or film until we actually saw the faces. And we're like, wait a minute. This is all CG. Holy yeah. This is a video game. So one of the cool things we did do, though, was we did the launch, a big launch party and a lot of stuff with Microsoft for Vista. And originally, I think Crysis was supposed to come out with Vista to show the next generation of PC gaming.
Right.
And I think that they wanted to kick it up a couple notches, so they delayed the release of it until just recently. It's amazing looking. You get a good graphics card, but you do need a pretty fast computer.
Yeah. Well, it can run under DirectX 10 or DirectX 9. I'm running it on 9. I'm actually running it on my MacBook Pro when I use boot camp. So that's kind of cool. My question is, when you work on a video game like that, the mixing is pretty incredible. I mean, the environments they do. Is a lot of that handled by the software? Is that in the software side? Or do you guys do like a mixed template?
In-game or cinematic?
In-game. This is all in-game stuff.
I have to admit, the in-game mixes were done by a gentleman named Joe, who's a really, really talented guy who's working out of Germany.
Right.
And but a lot of times when we do video games, there's...
Wait. So somebody actually does the in-game mixing?
Well,
or does he, like, set...
It's like...
And levels and...
It's the same way when you create a patch on whether using Contact or... like an EMU or any kind of sample-based setup, you've got to go in, you set parameters, you set key velocities, which is the same thing as distance. So you deal with XY coordinates, which is panning and distance. And so then if you've got a sound and you want to say that as it goes X amount of units back, we're going to put a low pass on. And then if it goes behind a wall, we're going to insert a reverb as an obstruction. So what you do... is you mix different environments based on the perspective. So what's different is you've got a camera that can keep moving to different places.
Right.
So you can be next to a gun. You can be 20 feet back from your gun. So the question is, how crazy do you want to get? And occasionally when you get the opportunity to work with a developer and a publisher, that it lets you really go after the details. So it can be like a weapon within the game might be four different elements.
Right.
That are mixed differently based on the spatialness of where your perspective is in relationship to that sound emitter. And it's complex. But what you do is you come up with all these scenarios and algorithms that help mix the project. You can then say that if you've got 100 voices that are playing at any given time, it's unbearable to hear all that sound. So you may do what they call prioritizing.
Right.
That says, okay, I only want to hear 10 sounds at once, even though 100 are triggering. And here's the volume levels of each because they're outside either a cone or a distance situation. Or if there's enemies running around, you don't, even though they theoretically have physics engines or triggering sounds,
right.
You don't necessarily want to hear it all because it'd be just unlistenable. So at that point, you have to then prioritize and kind of focus what you want the listener to listen to at any given time.
Now, is it, you don't mix on a board though, right? I mean, it's more like programming because you said
it's the same thing as mixing in Kontakt. In other words, take a sampler like Kontakt or any Mach 5, take any sampler that you want. And when you have different samples, you've got to mix them. So, no, there is no hardware controller.
Right.
It's done through software. There's middleware devices such as Weiss and FMOD. Then there's and the Exact from Microsoft and Scream from Sony. And then a lot of studios have their own proprietary audio engines. There's a lot of discussion about hooking up MIDI interfaces to these programs, but there's no real-timeness to.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I mean, it's the user is creating the real-time situation.
Right.
So it's the same way that if you walk around a tree, you've got a light source emitting a light, and then shadows will follow based on where the light source is and your perspective to that light source. Same thing with sound. If something is emitting sound, how does it sound at the different places, and then how do you want to do it? I mean, you can get as crazy as if someone starts shooting a gun and they come walk up to you, you can do different samples based on footages. So like at 1 foot using this sound, then another foot using this sound. Or when you record a sound, let's say a gun, you could use 10 different microphones. It's like the BFD drums. Oh, I got the room mic, I got the end of the snare mic, I got, you know, all these different situations. You're creating complex algorithms or setups, patches, in a very similar sense. But you've got to have the forethought to do that. I've seen a lot of people make the mistake where they do everything that way.
Right.
And it's so complex, either the audio engine can't play it or they're not allowing enough CPU cycles to allot for it because graphics is king.
I got you.
And audio is secondary. And anything that will slow down the graphics won't happen.
Now, how many sound elements when you design for a game like that? Are we talking thousands, tens of thousands? I mean,
in dialogue alone, you can have 25,000 lines.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we do 100,000, 25,000, 10,000. I mean, we have so many lines in some of these shows.
Right.
That's just the dialogue. And then for sound effects, you're looking at, about 1,500.
Wow.
Sound effects. It depends on how, if you want to do elements,
sure.
You can have more. And then some shooter games or something that's kind of simple can have 150. You know, music tends to be about 75 minutes.
Wow. Now, when they do music, do they ever break up stems and allow the user to kind of dictate the music mix? Because I was thinking, you know, when we were talking about this and I was doing some research on some of the stuff you're talking about, I mean, basically, mixing hasn't really changed forever. I mean, stereo mixing, you know, you're using a lot of the same principles that we've always used. And, you know, where would you take mixing if you wanted to go to the next level? And I'm thinking, wow, use some of the game engines that are out there. And, you know, I wonder if anybody's ever experimented with doing any type of that real-time mixing with different layers of audio.
I mean, music is done interactively. And what that means is three-dimensional. You've got a cue that goes horizontally. Think of it as when you create Pro Tools and you say you got a drum track and then a melody track, and you can break your tracks up and then rearrange them in any combination. So you could say play this cue with only the drums and the lead instrument, or play this with the drums and only the strings, or if it plays so many times, only play the melody so many times, otherwise it'll become repetitious. So, and it's based on what's happening within gameplay within the AI engine.
Right.
So if you're going to die, play the melody cue. If you're not going to die, play only the rhythm track. And it could be measure by measure. So what happens is kind of a little bit like Acid meets Appleton, but it's not being combined. It's only being combined in the computer. So what happens is if you're winning or you're winning quickly, the music will then be interactive with based on the gameplay and the emotional state that you've created. That stuff, I hate to say, is simple.
Right.
What gets complex is multiplayer games. Because now all of a sudden, there is no AI arc that says, hey, you're winning, you're losing. Now it's just, you know, you against another guy in another city who are playing online. So the emotional arcs are much harder to define.
You know, it really, when I'm listening to this technology as far as mixing, I mean, you think about it, mixing hasn't changed in forever. I mean, Andrew, as a mixer, do you ever see mixing involved to where you're mixing for more than just a stereo field? I mean, can you see any relevance of maybe doing some type of, you know, if when the systems get powerful enough that you can define as a user where you're sitting in the field and kind of, you know, assign parameters and sounds to the different instruments, but maybe, you know, let the user change their experience depending on where they want to be. I don't know what that is. I'm just thinking.
Well, I don't know. I mean, because for mixing records, there are usually so many choices that are made musically that the mix is trying to convey what their original intention was. I mean, that really is the point of a music mix, is to get the point across that the musicians were trying to make. And the mixes get so tweaky with turn this up half a dB, or I'll try panning that a little bit over here, and all these decisions are made in such tiny little parameters, I think you'd be hard-pressed to then convince the artist that, hey, let's let the listener take the drums out. You know, and to me, I love hearing other versions of a mix and things like that. I mean, that's one of the great things about CD singles for me, is you'd always get another version of a song.
Right.
But in terms of the final record mixes, I mean, other than perhaps doing a 5-1 mix or for a different speaker setup, I don't know how interactive that'll ever get. But that's also, I'm talking about, you know, traditional delivery methods.
Right.
So,
but what about like Beatnik? Remember that little program?
Yeah, and it's still around. I mean, there's a Thomas Dolby program where you'd basically get stems and do your own mix, you know? And Todd Rundgren did the same thing with one of his albums, where, okay, here's the drums, here's the bass, here are the guitars, here are the vocals, have fun.
Right.
And I think it was Nine Inch Nails put out – well, their band's putting out like GarageBand tracks of their record, and you can go do a remix or whatever. But you're not delivering – the album that way.
Right.
You're just delivering some elements so other people can do something else with them, not kind of make their own version of the album. You know, it's a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, I could just see using, you know, game technology. I mean, what if somewhere down the road, I don't know, even using maybe like a PlayStation or an Xbox where you can put in a music disc and use your joystick and kind of change your perspective or change your...
Well, I mean, it sounds like it's the perfect kind of thing for, you know, when you're on a treadmill. You know, like, hey, I like this music, but the music, instead of being a CD that just plays from beginning to end, is tracks that will build themselves based on how fast I'm going and my blood rate, my heart rate, and things like that. I mean, that's a market right there.
Xbox,
we should get to work.
There you go.
Xbox Live now has it where, especially when you play games a lot, you can start inserting your own music. So if there's something where, let's say, they do an orchestral score, it's John Williams, and it's very much, and someone goes, nah, I want something more edgier.
You can just load a CD that song goes with this game now.
Yeah. There's a lot of discussions about putting interactive music or selected cues that you can insert into your game the way you like it for, you know, 25 cents or...
Yeah, because, I mean, I just think there's some room, a lot of room there for some type of experience that people can have with music that's different from what it
but
is.
But I think
right
you
now.
Have to... write for it. Like with the Voodoo Lounge stuff, that stuff is written for surround. And so it takes advantage of it. And BT does the same thing. He writes for surround. So it really takes advantage of it. Whereas I think there's a lot of music that's been remixed for surround that suffers horribly because it wasn't meant for that. It was recorded for stereo and orchestrated for stereo and arranged for stereo, and then they split it up in five speakers, and you've got tambourines coming out of a speaker all by themselves.
I just heard Nightfly, Donald Fagen. What was that?
It's terrible.
There
are tracks where the bongos that you didn't know were in the song because they're meant to be a tiny part of the drum kit are all by themselves in the back.
What was that? Have you heard that? Have you heard the 5-1 version of that?
Not of the Nightfly. I've heard a bunch of other classic albums ruined, though.
Yeah. I'm listening to that because I was all excited and I popped it in and I'm like, what is this? You know, it lost that whole groove. It really did. It like split it up. So I know what you're saying.
I mean, I like because I do a lot of 7-5-1. I like it when you imagine you hear the band in a fully acoustic environment. But I'm not sure how much I enjoy being in the middle of the band.
Yeah, you don't ever sit there.
Yeah, you don't sit on stage at most of your favorite shows.
Which is why the live 5-1 is great, where you've got the band spread across the front and you sort of build the space that they were in behind you. And then it's
yeah,
exciting.
That I like.
That's very cool.
You never want to turn your head. And it's one of the things we've experimented a lot with, and you can toy with it a little bit. But like people say, you know, do you ever put Foley in the surrounds? And I'm like, little to never. Because what you don't want to do, you want to hear something back there, but I've done this with Oliver Stone films, where you actually want like a voice behind you, which makes you like, who's talking back there? But you want it to surround you, rather than make you look to the left, look to the right, look to the back.
Yeah, the last thing you want in the middle of a movie is to have somebody look at their living room wall because you've just broken the trance. Yeah.
Exactly.
They're
exactly.
not looking at the picture anymore.
Yeah, I just think there's something there in mixing that there's definitely a void, a progression that's stopped that with some of the new technologies that we could go to the next level. I mean, Rob, you know, in your studio, I mean, essentially, you're doing things the way you've done it forever. You ever see a progression of mixing, you know, in your studio that you're going to be mixing? Can you see yourself, I don't know, doing something, you know? I mean, where do you think mixing is going to go? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I converted my place to be surround mixable a few years ago, and we're actually now doing a bunch of music that's going to be done in surround and stereo simultaneously. But that's – I mean, I really – went up to surround to be able to do movie work. But we're actually working on some pop and R&B musical stuff now that is going to be sort of designed and surround from the first steps.
All right.
And songs are actually being written to take advantage of surround, but there will always be a stereo version. But I find in my studio, I try to make it as seamless as possible to go between stereo and surround. Because personally, for me, I mean, I've done so many zillions of projects in stereo. It's just fun to work in surround.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right.
You know, we always have to worry about what the delivery medium is, but there's a lot more ways to deliver surround music now than there used to be.
I guess with mixing, what it's really going to be a battle in the fact that you've got to think of the delivery. You've got to think of the back end.
Well, not only delivery, but just the listening environment that most people are going to listen to it in. I mean, and if it's music, we've had this conversation a bunch, sure. where now a huge percentage of people, it's only in headphones.
Right.
And you're lucky if it's anything bigger than earbuds.
Right.
But even people's home stereos. I mean, I still know people that have a stereo at home and they've got one speaker in the kitchen and one speaker in the living room. So, I mean, you can imagine listening to Beatles records over there. So it's pretty
like, this song has no drums.
But they wanted music in both rooms, and that's the way they set it up. And they may even kind of know that that's not right, but they don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care. Now, the only thing now is that surround systems for home theaters have become pretty easy to get and easy to set up. You buy them in a box, and it says, oh, just set it up. But to me, it's almost scarier because it's easy to be in the wrong place between two speakers.
Right.
It's almost impossible to be in the right place within five speakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, I think Scott will attest also to the fact that when you do any kind of work for home surround, you just have to assume every room's going to be set up wrong.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, one thing that – and I'm even guilty of this. The opportunity to have people – to have speakers behind you is almost impossible in most people's houses. Why? The couch is against the back wall. The TV's against the other wall. Guess where the surrounds are?
Yeah.
On your side.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, sometimes it's slightly.
We've got ours in the ceiling.
In the ceiling, but they're pretty much like above your head.
Yeah.
And same thing with us. Our surrounds are pretty much on the exact same plane as the couch. And because who's got a room that they can put speakers 4 feet behind the couch as if they have that much space?
Yeah. See, I found the solution to this. I don't have a couch.
It works out well. Something which I had a great fun with. There's a
wish that wasn't true, by the way.
he's got a little chair just
in the living room there. Well,
I actually did a mix with 420 speakers, and it's called the Esono system.
420?
420 speakers.
I actually heard it. It was pretty incredible.
It's
420.
Yeah, the Fraunhofer Institute created the system, and it's pretty trippy. Did you hear this? Andrew, did you ever hear this?
I think I've heard of something similar.
Okay.
I don't know. 420.
It's 6-inch drivers and tweeters, and they wrap around the whole dubbing stage. And they're all spaced, and they're all the way around.
Wait, is that like 419.1?
and
no, it's like 420.
And they've got subs. They got subs, but there's no like LCR. And what they do is they also have a bank of like 4 or 5 computers, and you can direct. Two things happen. First of all, you get full pan, so you could pan a sound. Actually, several things. You could take each speaker and pan all 420 speakers. You can then choose any group of speakers and say that one speaker now is maybe 10 speakers wide. And then you can pan that way. What you can also do is almost a version of HRTF, where what it does this whole phase relationship where you can make the room bigger or you can make the sound feel like someone's whispering right behind your ear. And it does work. It's really trippy.
Because all 420 speakers can cooperate. So you can tell it, you know, I'm standing in the middle of the room, but you can tell it I want it to sound like a whisper in my ear. And what that's going to tell it is, okay, these 8 speakers to the right need to fire a certain way. And then these speakers on the left need to fire a certain way with a different phase relationship to cancel things out to fool your ear into thinking it's coming from a direction.
So we did a video game, T2, a Terminator game. And we did it as a demo for Esono. And it was great because we had like one of the voices were going up and down the rows, and you can actually hear somebody whisper and walk by you, no headphones.
Wow!
And you can spot, and you had a, and then what we did was we gave people after the demo the ability to grab their mouse pad and actually press to places where the seats are, and that's where the voice was.
Wow!
And It was amazing, and it was very, it's like $350,000.
Yeah, it wasn't real practical for the
home. But how big is the sweet spot for the listening?
The sweet spot, well.
It would move.
The sweet spot's different in different places. I mean, there is no.
It would depend which speakers you were using. You could move the sweet spot. That's actually what was cool, because you could sit in the middle of the room and move the sweet spot over your head, and all of a sudden it would feel like the sound went through your head.
Right, but I'm saying for a listener listening back to this, you have to be right in the middle.
It depends on what you want to do. We kind of created almost a 5-channel front and an infinite amount of surrounds. But what was neat was instead of having an LCR, we can have dedicated speakers doing like a left center or center right, or because we had different speakers that were all firing slightly different. So it was actually amazingly cool, and it was a lot of fun. The only problem we found was dome tweeters don't cut through screens very well. And what happened was when you're sitting in a theater, because there's no horn-type system, to be able to shoot dialogue back 80 feet, you needed to use, like, you know, half of your whole fronts just for dialogue. So you started losing the point source directionality of it. So it was almost like you needed to get a LCR enhancement. It was very fascinating. You know, everyone went, wow, because they thought they could change theater, film.
Sure.
You know, the first thing I did was call my buddies from Cirque and said, guys, I think there's something you got to hear. So, you know, Disney came by and Cirque came by and everybody, Cirque being Cirque du Soleil, and just all these different theme parks, Universal. I mean, it was actually fun because I was one of the demoers.
Right.
And we did it for a week, and it was like parties.
Wow.
And everyone's like, great. But everyone's like, how much? And Fraunhofer wasn't selling the unit like, hey, come buy this unit. They were selling the technology to somebody who would build it.
Right.
And sell it to the masses. Oh. So I think we had it in our place for about 6 months over at Radford Studios, the once Radford Studios. Yeah. And
may rest in peace.
And now I think they moved the system over to Disney.
Wow, that's amazing. All I know.
Oh, I was just going to say, and in answer to what you were talking about, Andrew, you could actually, you could walk pretty far off to the edge. And it was amazing that the effect worked basically.
So you could
everywhere
get a group of people
room.
In there.
You could get a big group of people.
Wow.
Right. Yeah, I think unless you had your head pressed up against one of the walls, you basically could hear the effect. And the speakers weren't mounted randomly. They had these brackets that they had figured out, you know, for how the speakers had to be, you know, dealing with the curvature of the room. And the speakers weren't just mounted flat on the wall. They had all the physics of it figured out, and then they'd feed all of the exact locations into a computer that would then make up for the distance between them. But you could walk all the way to a wall and still hear what was happening elsewhere.
It was great. And I know that one of the concepts they want to do, which is a little bit further out, is to create, you know, these things called wall speakers. They're basically transducers that are basically walls.
Right.
And they want to basically, in your house, in your home theater, build this kind of system with a computer that can
control it.
Control your whole, you know.
Wow.
And if you don't mind a home theater that costs twice as much as your home. You know, it's practical.
Bill Gates bought one.
Wow. Well, hey, listen, this is going to be a good place to take a break right now. And then when we come back, we'll do some visiting with Tom. Tom, what do you think about all this wacky mixing when you're back then? It was all mono, right? When you're doing all those.
If it wasn't mono, we'd never finish.
Wait.
All right.
Well, Scott's movie all impression.
Can you imagine calibrating all those speakers, though? What a job. That would be just amazing. Well, anyhow, we'll pick this up when we get to the other side of the break, so we'll see you.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about mixing and the fantastic 419.1. That just sounds awesome.
We always like to say it's the 1.5.
The 1.5.
One mono and five subs, yes.
And then we were also talking with Tom. And Tom used to work for Hanna-Barbera. And why don't you just fill us in a little bit on your work that you did when you were over at Hanna-Barbera and some of the stuff that you did back then?
Well, I'm probably the oldest guy in this group, so, you know, for the guys that originated in post and dealt with the real hardcore combining effects and trying to make things work, and then go up and have a mixer try and play them the way that you heard them on your moviola, just never worked out quite right. But so I appreciate everything that you guys are talking about today and understand the nuances and the difficulties that you go through trying to create something that lives in somebody's head,
mm-hmm.
and have them try and explain it to you and then have you reproduce that somehow with nothing to work with. It happens all the time. But sound has definitely evolved to the point of no return. It's going to be whatever anybody comes up with at any given time. And ultimately, if there's a market for it, it will have legs. And in the event that it doesn't, it will go away quickly. But it's all still really exciting. I don't really get into the real heavy, detailed effects stuff that I used to deal with. I turn it over to the pros now.
Uh-huh.
You know, the computer savvy guys like you, Mike.
That's true. I've actually mixed a couple animation things for him. Well, why don't you explain a little bit about what you used to do, about some of the sound effect work that you did back in the day with.
Well, it's, you know, I don't know how many here have, I mean, we all remember quarter inch and mags. Anybody here actually cut effects on mag or cut music on mag?
I think I've been known as the worst mag effects cutter on this. In the
But that was a real challenge in those days, just from the standpoint of, especially like at Hanna-Barbera, where you would have this long hallway of rolls of mag that were labeled as a specific effect or a combination of effects. And you had to really know the whole library. There wasn't an index. There wasn't a catalog to go to. You had to learn it by listening to it and then remember it or make your own notes.
Let me just interrupt you. Why don't you explain what mag is for the people that are out there? Because
it's magnetic particles on film. Basically, it's tape on a film format.
Okay. So it was like getting like regular analog tape that ran at the same speed.
But think of it as half inch or even 1 inch. I mean, it was thick.
Right.
And the quality of it was really good, and it wasn't very delicate.
It would be tough to break unless it.
Yeah.
You had it around for 10 years, and that was very fragile. And you had to keep on reproducing it. So you'd actually have a master somewhere that would be stored, and in the event that roll ran out, you just go get the loop and reproduce another 1,000 feet of it.
And are we talking like in the 70s, 80s, or?
Yeah, in the 70s.
Yeah.
So you'd have the hallway with all the different mag rolls, and you'd have to know they weren't indexed, or they were labeled, or?
No, because, you know, even if you would index something, it wasn't necessarily, it would be, if you gave a name to something that wasn't relevant, it's just, how you would describe it, it's not what it really sounds like to somebody else. So
right.
You really had to know the sound.
Wow.
And, you know, there were just thousands and thousands. And, you know, for the years past, editors that came in and had their own, created their own concoction, so to speak, and then they'd give it some name like Mike's Effects. Well, what is that?
And really obnoxious sounds.
Yeah.
So take us through. You have this big, big sound effects hallway, and you pick your sounds. Now, you were working on a moviola, so basically you were mirroring that reel of mag, like, you know, Fred Flintstone, Bongo Run, or whatever, against that action. And would you just line up a bunch of those? How did that work back then? How did you get from there to the stage?
Well, you pretty much had to, you know, take that effect off the rack, find modulation. And anybody who's worked on a moviola, you realize that you have to disconnect the calipers to, you know, isolate one sound head so that you could play the sound, mark that modulation, then lock it all back up with picture and see if it worked or not. If it worked, great. Or if you needed to cut it down, if it was something you could cut on mag, you would try it. And ultimately, if the effect worked, you would, you know, cut it off at the heads and cut it off at the tails and mark your picture, like effect 49 would be what you'd write on your mag, and on your picture you would write effect 49. So eventually, when you had 300 sound effects, you would then take your picture, put it on the bench, go through and have leader on all the rolls, subsequent rolls to build the effects tracks. You would then start laying in all these effects based on where that number came up on your picture.
And then put leader in between?
Leader would roll in between if there was nothing on that track until the next effect came up where you could insert that effect. Or sometimes you were out 10, 12 tracks on just, you know, a half-hour animation show.
Tell them how you did a fade.
Well, a fade was
you didn't
really
just hit Control F?
Yeah.
Did you draw it in?
Fades were really the real trick, because if you were good at it, you made great fades. If you screwed it up, you started over. You had to get the effect again, cut it, but you would take acetone and you would tape down the effect on your bench from head to tail, and then get a ruler potentially and mark the angle of the fade for, you know, full modulation to no modulation at the end. And then you would take the acetone and start wiping that mag until that mag disappeared.
Off the film.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And so if you wanted a four inch fade, you know, a quick one, you would have to map that out. And then if you wanted a foot long fade, you'd have to map that out.
And where did all the mag particles go?
Up your nose.
Now, how many tracks? Okay, because each mag machine would just be one track of audio, correct?
Yeah. You'd have 100.
You'd have to lock up, if you had like 12 tracks, 32 tracks, you'd have 32, 12 machines?
No, they'd have to pre-mix.
So you'd pre-mix. And how many, when you're actually doing the mix, you'd take, you know, 12 tracks, would you go down to 6 tracks? So when you're on stage, you're only working with 8
It really depends upon where you are.
I got you.
And how many mixers were on that stage.
Like, how many mixers would mix, like, a typical Hanna-Barbera cartoon from that age?
Anywhere from 2 to 3. It would depend.
And how many tracks wide were they? Do you remember? I mean,
usually had, if you cut music as well, which we did, you could be out 6 wide for music and anywhere from 10 to 15 for effects. Then you had your dialogue track as well.
It sounds like you were on the editing side of audio. Were you also creating effects, or was that a completely different set of people? What was the division between the people who would create the sounds and the ones who would edit and then mix it?
Well, the fun part of that was when you'd get into situations where you just didn't have anything, but you had an idea of how to potentially create it. You would get the Niagara, go outside or take it home or do whatever you were going to do and try and create it. Ultimately, if you could, like you can now, digitally, it's so easy to combine stuff and mix it on the fly and just get the exact sound that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was, you know, it was difficult because if you had to combine sounds to get what you were looking for, it was hard because you didn't really have the controls you had now. So if you could take, you know, most you would try and combine sounds would be like three tracks at one time because mm-hmm. you ultimately couldn't play all of them beyond three to hear it
right
on a moviola or a flatbed or whatever it may be. So, you know, now it's so easy. Just go to the library, drag something in. You can, you know, drag stuff in and play with it till the cows come home.
But did you have, back then, did you have license to just go and record whatever you thought you might need? Was it openly creative that way?
It depended if it took you away from work for a week and nobody knew where you were. You know, if it was something that was manageable within a couple hours.
Because just going back and listening to the old classic Hanna-Barbera cartoons, it's so obvious that a lot of that stuff was just dreamt up by creative people. Yeah. And obviously that had to take a long time.
Yeah. And a lot of it's very musical as well. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the sounds that you hear or you think are, well, that's an interesting sound. Well, it's really a musical sound.
I'm sure that was actually one of them.
It was interesting because as the computer age evolved and a lot of students were coming out of school and, you know, had computer savviness on their side and were creative in that sense, you know, they really don't understand how it used to be and how it originated and really how it evolved. Because you'd say, I mean, they had no idea when you told them you were working, you know, 24 frames. They're like, what does that mean? Yeah. You know, what is mag? What's a movie? You know, all that, you know, is foreign to them, which is fine, you know, because it is ultimately better now.
You know what? One of the things we've talked about before is, you know, it's so easy for anybody to create music now, where it used to be you needed a big budget to get into a real studio and it took a whole lot of people and a lot of know-how and everything else. And now it's real easy to create music, but it doesn't mean that a lot of that music is good. It just means that anybody who wants to try can try it. And it's so obvious that the same thing is true of, I mean, if you want to talk specifics, cartoon sound effects. Because you think of all the classic cartoon sound effects, none of them are from the 80s, 90s, and 2000 and up. And it's way easier now. Obviously, anybody can drag a sound effect to a frame of picture and lay it in and mix it with 10 million other sounds and mix it however they want. It doesn't make them creative, and it doesn't mean that great work is going to come out of it. And it's still, you know, there's a reason people still sample records from the 70s, and there's a reason that when people think of a classic cartoon sound effect, it's from maybe as old as the 40s or 50s even.
Yeah.
Because back then, fewer people could do it, but the people who made it to the top of that profession were really creative and really great. And, you know, had the tools been easier back then, those same guys would have been doing just as amazing work, but you would have had a much bigger pool like you do now. And I think that just like, you know, we've talked about before, you have to sort of forget about the tools. You know, be grateful for the tools you have. Be grateful. It's so much easier now than it was back then. But just know that there's no substitute for the real creativity and really, you know, having talent and
sure.
working your butt off.
I do think there's still good work happening today.
There's definitely good work, but the way that work is accomplished is really different than the past. And there was something about the old way that caused
to work harder.
Well, you had to work harder, but somehow things
Yeah, stood the test of time.
Well, I think the key is when he said, you know, you heard it in your head and then you tried to realize it, whereas now you don't try to hear it in your head because you can just audition 1,000 things so quickly, one of them might work.
Yeah,
and then
it'll
turn out, oh, well, that's cool, rather than getting it fully formed before you even start, because you know once you go down a road, it's going to be difficult, it's going to take time, it's going to cost money, and it's the same thing with the music. You know, you just whip through a bunch of loops and like, oh, that's cool. Rather than having an idea of what the feel of the song should be before you even start.
Right.
What's interesting in listening to all of you talk in the first half was, you know, as we mature age-wise in technology, you know, we grow with things, but we tend as humans to be more analytical. And it's easy to be analytical, so we tend to rely on that side of our brain that says, well, you know what, two follows one, so... You know, that works for me. I do a lot with preschool shows as well. And it's totally different venue from the standpoint of kids are intuitive. They don't know that two follows one. They just know from the visual and the audio portion of it what connects to them. So you don't have to explain it to them. They'll get it or they won't get it. And so they're much more perceptive in the sense of, you know, we try and fit, you know, the round peg into the round hole, whereas, you know, with kids, it's less is more.
Yeah.
And I've gone through all the things, you know, of trying to pile on more and more and more and more, and then you get to a medium where it's like, well, this is way too complicated. Well, what do you mean? Well, they don't know what the character is really saying. They just know whether they like it or not. They like the colors, or they like the way that it moves, or the visuals, whatever it may be. If the sound is, you know, appealing and appetizing to them, and it somehow moves them, they're cool with it. That's all they need. They don't need any more. And it's interesting because I tend to fall back on that at times when, you know, we just want to. It's not enough. We just got a we've got a little hole here with nothing going on. What can we put there? It's like, why do you need it? Let it be. If it's working, let it be. And we tend to fight that. Do you guys find that as well, especially in music? I mean, do you find that, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the key, yeah. I mean, a lot of the people I work with were people bring a song and they've already been working on it for a long time and it's got a lot of guitar parts and it's very intricate. And there'll be a problem in the song. Let's say getting into the chorus doesn't feel right or whatever. And every single time I hand them an acoustic guitar and say, play the song. And when you hear them on one instrument and the melody going from the verse to the chorus, okay, that works. And you can figure out exactly what they didn't manage to translate into this very complicated version of their song. And it's the only way to figure stuff out is to come back to the very, very simple version.
Mm.
And a lot of times, and this is why working with Rick Rubin, I mean, you look at these Johnny Cash records that he's made in the Neil Diamond stuff. That's his theory, and you don't ever go complicated. Bring it back until the essence is obvious and leave it there, and that's it. And
you know,
it's huge.
I totally agree, and something I'm dealing with that right now. I'm doing a football movie, and it's shot... A lot of inspirations from Oliver Stone and stuff, where the camera's moving all the time. We're going to black and white. We're in color. The energy that's coming off the visuals are huge, and people are running, and you've got your character going between other linemen. It's not bad from a drama mean, but it's got a lot of energy. So, you know, the first thing you do is say, okay, let's cover most of what we're seeing. And then you hear it back, and we're like, it's unlistenable. Because what am I supposed to be hearing? Because it's too much. And what I've been doing for weeks, you know, we did the Foley, we've done our effects, we've done everything. And I've got, you know, easily 192 tracks going that I'm auditioning. And now I'm just going, okay, get rid of that wall of line, get rid of this grunt, get rid of that little bit of Foley that's hanging over that one little piece of movement. And I'm literally carving, fine tuning. And because I want to hear the lead guy who's got the ball going, and then
and
boom.
That's all you need.
That's all you need.
And, I mean, because probably your most recognized work, I'd probably sonically, was American Beauty, right? Which has completely silent scenes.
Oh yeah, I mean it's
and it's a great use of that because then the sound becomes very important. And 2001 has a lot of scenes like that too, right. The Kubrick movie where there's nothing and then there's one person breathing. And yeah, you could cover everything you see, but it's not powerful anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, working with I've mixed a couple projects for Tom, and a couple times, you know, we've edited all these effects and put these really, you know, brilliant little scenes together, and he gets in there and goes, let's get rid of that. And all I just saw was just all my hard work and effort. Just like, oh no.
Are you producing these projects or doing?
Yeah.
That's great.
Pretty much producing now.
Yeah.
So you're not just doing the sound stuff.
Actually, I don't really do sound that much anymore. I'm doing a little bit right now on a project that Mike's going to mix for me, but, it's for a presentation for a big retailer that I can't mention that will hopefully buy into the concept and it'll be huge. But, at that stage, I like to be close to it, the creative process. Now, again, to compliment you guys, in what you do with music, what I really like to do, and this doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen, obviously, is I like to go ahead and if I was doing effects, like on this little thing I'm doing, I went ahead and did the effects, but want to make sure the music's done so that I can play it against the music. And any effect, in my opinion, any effect that fights the music and or has some sort of conflict with it, it's out. It's gone. It may be replaced or it may not need anything there because there is a relationship there that's so, so crucial. And it's so harmonious in the when it works, but you have to look at it as, you know, these two elements, the music and the effects, need to come together to be one. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, you know, it fights and people are, you know, disjointed and it disrupts them. And that's falling back into, you know, a young kid, you know, 2 to 4 years old. You know, they don't need a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why it works together because it's less is more, and it follows a path that's you know smooth and cohesive and soothing, and so it's interesting, you know, like this when Mike will mix this now, I've already balanced the effects in the sense of the sound or the quality of that effect against the music because I have a tendency to like, you know, what the music brings. If the composers are, you know, hitting and matching action, sometimes they can do it so much better than an effect can do it. Now we hear something break. If it's glass, we need to hear glass break to a certain extent. But in the event that, you know, the impact is also being matched and created with the music, then we don't need as much of it because it's help selling it as well. So we have to share that space, basically.
Well, and did you find it hard to transition from being in the trenches as a sound effects guy to being a level above creatively where you have to look at the whole project and the sound effects is just one element? Was that a hard transition or did that feel pretty natural? Because a lot of times I've heard like a sound effects guy will move up into that position and all of a sudden everything they ever produce has really loud sound effects. And it sounds like you're not thinking that way at all.
Yeah, no, you know, it's you have to let things flow that need to flow. And when you're talking about less effects, you know, that it needed silence to be effective. You have to really just take in the whole picture each time and every project's different.
Was that an easy transition for you though?
I would say the transition was easy for me because I am old school in that sense of how I had to figure out how to make sounds work together in a very complicated environment, you know, with MAG and so on and so forth. The computer side of it, of creating stuff now, is just like, this is just way too easy. This is just, you know, I can, you know, it should be, everything should end up being magical because it's so easy.
Right.
So I would get more frustrated by the people that were doing that work when I started producing because they weren't creative. It's right. Like, it's a sound and stuff would hang over you know, the effect, the actual action had stopped, but the effect was still playing. It just drive me crazy.
I think Tom didn't have – as a mixer who was supervised from Tom, the great thing about Tom being a producer and a supervisor is, number one, I remember the first time I met him, the one thing that just went through my mind was – don't piss this guy off. Because his voice is so deep and so
great. You got a great voice, by the way.
I was like, man, I just don't want...
You don't want to be yelled at by that guy.
That's right. And the second thing was, he knew what he wanted. I mean, you know, he just knew exactly what he wanted. And he knew when something worked and he knew when something didn't work. And that, you know, that's half the battle right there. If you're working for a client, who knows
what Well, that
he
comes
wants.
From working...
Yeah.
Using technology where you were forced to know what you were doing before you did it, which is great.
So
it did help. And, the interesting thing is, I think that in the past, you know, you'd always have composers that just hated effects people because they were just getting in the way of the music. They would just clobber
you
stuff.
You can't hear my piccolos. What?
Yeah. I've worked kind of hard at balancing that, you know, letting them have their say, you know, and represent their music, because it is important. And effects, you know, really go a long way without killing everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great to just have lots of noise in there, and that's where you...
So do you like Saving Private Ryan without the music?
I'll say this, that ultimately we've all heard, you know, the cliche, you know, music will fix it, music will save it. I think that that's true and not true. If you go back to, let's just say, Tom and Jerry cartoons when there were no sound effects and there was no dialogue and it was all music, mm-hmm. did you not understand what was going on? We all understood what was going on, so not a problem. Now, I think that there's a real void in filmmakers today in the sense of bringing out the emotion in their audience. And I'll explain this way. When I left, I spent 7 years at Hanna-Barbera the first time, and then I left from there and went into live action. And I worked with Michael Landon for about 7 years. For whatever reason, whether you liked any of Mike's shows or not, Mike had this gift of making the audience feel something. It was, I mean, you look back at it now, and it's just kind of like, you know, Pollyanna, a little bit hokey. But you never left that show without feeling something. And I think that part of the art is not missing. It's trying to be expressed in different ways that not everybody's connecting. I mean, you look at the paper at any given time or on the internet and look at all the movies that are out there and what they're actually doing, and it's like, we're just producing stuff for the concept of producing stuff. I mean, I can watch some shows and come to tears. Other shows, it's like, I'm disgusted. So for whatever reason, for me, different things work for me. There's something in that movie that connected, and I feel like, you know, it drew something out of me that was emotional. And I think that if we don't feel something emotionally, we don't really get attached to it. So the concept of, you know, having emotions and however they're evoked, mm-hmm. good, bad, or indifferent, in all of us, whatever that message is coming at us and whatever they're trying to say, if it creates an emotion, I think that's probably good. If we don't like what we're seeing or what they're doing, that's probably still good. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So much of the stuff, and even with cartoons now, it's just nonsensical. I mean, some of the stuff that I have worked on and some of the things that I'm currently working on are really nonsensical. It's just, let's push the envelope as far as we can, and let's make it edgier. And it's just, it's to the point of, we need to fill a void, so let's just put something in there. You know, it's kind of crazy. I think it's kind of lost its magic to a certain extent.
I just have one quick question for you, because I know you're not cutting on Mag anymore. And if you're doing sound work now, what are you using now, and how hard was it to transition to whatever it is?
My biggest problem is that when I'm using Pro Tools,
I would like to point out, he's not like 150 years old here, ladies and gentlemen. The way Mike introduced him, there's no long gray beard or anything.
Yeah. Using Pro Tools, the transition, I think what happened to me, technology is not my strong suit by any means. I know enough to be dangerous. And it's always important to understand what things do, what software can produce, so that when you ask somebody else to do it and they say, well, I don't know if I can do that, you know that software can do it. You just need to find somebody else to do it for you.
Right.
So from a producing standpoint, that's huge. Where the evolution came from Mag into, the computer side, it was sort of when I started producing. And so I started getting away from that technology as being hands-on. Right. If you're not hands-on in something every day, it's evolving so quickly, it can become foreign real fast.
Sure.
But
so because you were moving sort of up the creative chain at that point, the change in the technology wasn't affecting your daily work as much as just having to understand the new concepts.
I just need to understand it so that whoever I was dealing with knew that this is what needed to be done and how it needed to be done, per se. Or I needed to understand how they were going to do it to make sure that the end result was what I wanted.
Yeah, to know what to ask for.
Yeah. So, ultimately, when you're producing, you have so many other elements to keep track of, sure. Especially the schedule and the budget. You don't have time. You rely on I hire Mike to do things for me and other people as well, because they're good at what they do, and then you have to allow them to do what they do.
And they just want to hear stories about what you used to do.
Hey, I'm going to jump in here because we're going to have to wrap this up.
Nope, but, sorry. talking here.
But I will tell you, Tom is pretty amazing because, A, not only does he work on Pro Tools, but what he's not talking about, and I'm going to, toot his horn, is he does picture editing too. He works on the Avid as well as Final Cut. I mean,
yikes.
He's truly a post-production stud, I will say that. All right, well, hey, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really interesting, and hearing some of those stories just makes me love Pro Tools even more. I'm just going to go hug it. I'm going to go hug it right after the podcast, because I couldn't imagine doing a fade by, trying to get acetone and try to,
You know what, though? Everybody should go visit a Moviola in a museum sometime, because that stuff actually was really cool.
Actually, when you see a Moviola nowadays, they're like great, like, art pieces. I mean,
they are.
I mean, I would buy one and just put it somewhere just as a nice art piece, because it's really
cool.
That's
what they have outside Scott's office.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap this up, but before we go, Rob, you working on anything that you can talk about?
Working on a few things I still can't talk about. The furniture is coming in, though.
That's
the studio
awesome.
Actually has some new furniture.
I think we should start the furniture countdown.
Oh, I think we're way beyond that, but it's been 8 months, and hopefully by next podcast, I'll be able to report that everything's at least in the building.
That's great.
But now most of it's in the building. But the other thing I should mention, Sound on Sound magazine this month, apparently, an article and interview that my production partner, Gary O, did that I'm also involved with is out. It's a really long article about the making of Stevie's album Songs in the Key of Life.
Wow.
Which Gary engineered and mixed along with John Fishbeck. And they did a really long interview with Gary. And then I, of course, was still in diapers when that album was put together. I wasn't with Stevie yet. That's one funny thing. I've been with Stevie for 22 years, and I'm still the new guy.
Wow. But, you and Ronnie Wood.
Yeah, exactly. We're the new kids. But they brought me in to talk about, in sidebars, some more recent stuff with Stevie, stuff that's only 20 years old.
Right.
And then also I demonstrated in pictures the way some of the technology worked. I think they used pictures of me with the Dream Machine, which is a really rare keyboard that Stevie has, two of the four that were ever made. And it's a really, really, really long interview, but it was really well done. And supposedly the pictures of me are in there, and the pictures of Gary, and it turned out pretty good from what I hear.
Is that the December issue?
It's the December issue. I haven't actually seen it yet.
They have a U.S. version as well as an English
version?
I
think they do. I did get an email from a friend in England who said he was just thumbing through and saw a picture of me holding a Yamaha GX1 memory card.
Okay. So I'll have to check it out.
That's the only reason he would have seen that.
I don't have the latest issue yet, so that's cool.
But so that should be out soon.
Great. Andrew, are you working on anything?
I got nothing like that. but we have a pond with some fish in it, you know, that we didn't used to have. So I got that going for us.
Hey, that works. Yeah. That works.
So that's good.
The raccoons will thank you.
No. They have a rock to go under.
Oh, okay.
So the raccoons will not get to them.
That's what we thought at my place. For
yeah, that's, okay. That's a conversation for next time.
That's right.
Ooh,
that's
a great.
Fish countdown.
But that's it, huh?
Yeah, I'm just working. You
gotcha.
Know, nothing.
Nothing you can talk about.
Yeah, nothing terribly exciting. But that Cass McCombs record we talked about a couple of podcasts ago, he was actually on KCRW this morning.
Oh.
Morning Comes Clock. I think he played the Henry Fonda Tonight. So,
ooh.
And Amoeba's recommending it. So that's good. It's getting a little bit of buzz.
That's great.
Yeah.
Scott, I know you're on your movie, your football movie.
I'm still on my movie. I'm not until February. But December 5th. For anyone who was in LA and in gaming, we're throwing a big party, Gang ISD, Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers,
right.
From the Game Audio Network Guild. We are throwing our first big bash in LA over at the Lantana Studios Taddeo on Olympic. And, it's great. We're going to be giving up prizes. SC Electronics has given us the mics to donate, Hollywood Edge, Microsoft and Sony. We're going to be giving games out.
Great.
And you, Mike?
And you, Mike, yeah.
What you got?
Just detoxing, you know, just working on some extra content for some more DVD stuff and a couple of commercials, but nothing really, really big.
And Bobby and Martin aren't here, but I assume Martin is working on the album release and Bobby is working on something.
It's, when is the release?
I will let him tell us next time.
Because he won't be out before that.
It's soon. I know it's soon. Well, hey, Tom, thanks for joining us today. And we really appreciate you coming over.
All right, Tom.
Yay! Making us appreciate our Pro Tools systems just a little bit more. And Ken, thank you so much for your engineering. We always appreciate when you're here. And hey, if you have any questions or comments, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. You can also reach us on our MySpace page. That's myspace.com/audionowcast. All right. Well, hey, gang, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.